Okay, we are live. Welcome back to another episode in our series, Tefillah of the Past, the Practical and the Profound. We've been on a quasi hiatus for the past month or so because I was away, and then the last time we met at the senior luncheon instead of here as our regular meeting time. And I want to start today's lecture by sharing a story. Several years ago, someone shared with me a video of a certain prominent rabbi in Eretz Yisrael, and he was talking about how important it is to daven on Purim. He said, on Purim, your tefillos can make an impact that they can't make an impact the rest of the year. On Purim, your tefillos can have a roshem and shemayim in a way that's not possible during the other 364 days in the Gregorian calendar. And on Purim, therefore, we have to be very deliberate and very persistent and very proactive about our tefillos on that day. And a person might watch that video and say, what on earth is this rabbi talking about? Tefillah is important every day. What is so special about Purim? You want to say, oh, maybe on a yard site and the zechus of the neshama, something like that. But Purim? Why is tefillah on Purim any different than tefillah on Hanukkah or on Sukkot or on Pesach? You want to say Yom Kippur? Oh, maybe I can understand why Yom Kippur would have a special status vis-a-vis tefillah. Why is he talking about Purim? And the truth is, you will find tons of these videos in an internet search. The power of tefillah on Purim. And it begs the question, why? Where are these rabbis getting this from? Where do they get this from? How do we know? Why is it that Purim is such a special day when it comes to tefillah? And that's what we're going to talk about today. We have Purim coming up on the horizon. It's just in a couple of weeks. And if I were to ask you what the most prominent themes of the holiday are, not mitzvot, I'm saying what are the most prominent themes of the mitzvot, of the holiday, excuse me, what would you say? Just curious.
Well, in the spirit of Purim, I'll say it's my birthday. Uh-huh.
Okay. So we have one birthday, but I don't think your birthday appears in the Megillah, with all due respect. So what's a theme? What are some of the themes of the Purim story?
Simcha.
Simcha? Why Simcha? Okay, right. There's an idea of simcha on Purim. In fact, the entire month of Adar, our sages teach me, Shenichnas Adar Marbin B'Simcha. Great, simcha is certainly a theme of Purim. What else? Anybody else?
Nistar.
Say that again.
Nistar, hidden.
God's name does not appear in the Megillah. God's presence is hidden from the Megillah. I'm assuming that's what you're referencing.
Well, everything is hidden.
Everything is hidden. God's hand in the entire salvation is hidden. Okay, yeah, great. Yeah.
I hesitate to say this, but it's vaguely political, but Israel, the Jewish people need the support of a large external power. So we are too small to do it alone. So if we without the support of Ahasuerus, the people would be done for. Now, there is a hint that there is salvation would have come from something else, but
If you had to put that in a word, what's the theme?
Well, I guess you could. Well, there is a theme of salvation. Where is it coming from? Where does salvation come from?
Okay, great. The reason I'm asking this question is because I think most people have put to this question would not answer prayer as one of the major, most obvious, visible themes of Purim. Sure, prayer plays a part in the Purim story, but I don't think Purim is known for tefillah. I don't think the Purim story is spoken about with any frequency, at least generally speaking, in terms of its connection to the idea of Jewish prayer. And I'm not saying it doesn't appear, but I'm just saying, and you can see from asking this question, it's not what comes to mind when people are asked about the tefillah.
Community cohesion, he tells people not to show to the banquet they do. It's complicated.
I'm not sure I understand what you're getting at.
Well, what you were saying about they don't think about prayer, but there is the concept of prayer and also community cohesion of how if someone is ordered to prayer, Mordecai orders 300 or whatever children, tells people not to go to the banquet if you're not getting it, it's okay.
Right, no, prayer features in the story. The point that I'm trying to make is that people don't think of it as one of the highlights or as one of the most prominent parts of that story. And the truth is that prayer is actually an unlikely theme of Purim. And after we see it, you're not going to be able to unsee it as one of the most important themes of the holiday and of the day. And the truth is that it does appear in the Megillah. It doesn't stop there, but it certainly appears in the Megillah in several places. In Perek Dalet Pasuk Aleph, in source number 1, we're told to Mordechai Yadet Kol Asher Naseh Vayikra Mordechai Et Begadav, that Mordechai tore his clothes when he found out about what was going to happen. And Vayetze B'toch Ha'ir Vayizak Ze'aka Gedola Umara, that he went out through the city, he was crying out loudly and bitterly, which implicitly seems to be a reference to Tefillah, and some mafarshim explain explicitly that what he's doing here was he's davening. Also, Esther Perig Tetz Pasuk Kilamed Aleph, at the very end of the Purim story, we're told Lekayim Mesimei Purim Ha'ele Bizmaneim Kasher Kaim Alei Mordechai Yehudi VeEsther Malka Hamalka Kasher Kaimu Al Nafsham VaAlzarim Divrei Hatsumos VeZaakasam, that these days of Purim should be observed at their proper time, as Mordechai the Jew, and now Esther Hamalka, has obligated them to do. They have to keep Purim in all generations. Their descendants, the obligation of fasting, v'za'akatan, and their, it says lamentations here, but a better translation is probably their crying out. So we see that people were crying out. It seems to be that they were davening, that they were praying. And this comes up at least a couple of times in the Purim story, and it doesn't stop there. It doesn't stop there. The sages in the Talmud, the sages in the Gemara, in a number of places, mostly in Maseches Megillah, talk about how even some things in the Megillah that don't seem like they have anything to do with Tefillah are actually veiled references to Tefillah. One example can be found in source number 3. If you look in the Megillah, Maseches Megillah, Daf Yud Beis Amid Beis, the Megillah describes Mordechai famously as Ish Yehudi Haya B'Shushan Habira, Ish Yimini. Okay, so my Ka'amar. What does this mean, the Gemara says? Why is the Megillah going into all of the ancestors of Mordechai? That he was an Ish Yimini, and they say that he was also a Ben Kish and various other things. Why are we talking about Mordechai's ancestry? How is who Mordechai descended from an important part of the Purim story? So the Gemara says, Ili chuse kaasi. So the Gemara says, if you're coming to try to trace his ancestry, you're just trying to show who he is and identify the man, well, liachse liezel al Binyamin. You should trace him all the way back to Binyamin. In other words, if you're trying to identify Mordechai and show his lineage, then why stop part of the way through? Why not just go all the way back to Binyamin? Binyamin, one of Yosef's sons, and talk about Binyamin, one of Yaakov's sons, and talk about how that was his father, his father's father's father's, etc. father. Ela Maishnahi. Why is the Torah telling us of Mordechai's ancestry? Well, each one has a reference. Kulan al Shimoni Krau. It's because all of these are names by which Mordechai was called. He was called Ben Yair, the son of Yair, not only maybe literally because he was the son of Yair, but also Ben Shehir Einayim Shel Yisrael B'Tfilaso, because that is what he did. He Yair, what does Yair mean? To light, to shine. And what did Mordechai do? He was Heir Einayim Shel Yisrael B'Tfilah. He lit up the eyes of Jews with his prayer. Also, Ben Shimi is another phrase that we attribute to Mordechai. What does this mean? He's not just the son of Shimi. He is Ben Shama, which is where the root word Shimi comes from. Ben Shama El Tfilaso. That he was son of God who heard his prayers. And lastly, Ben Kish. Why? Shehi Kish. What does he keep? What does Lahakish mean? To knock, to bang on the doors of Sha'arei Rachamim V'Niftechu Lo, because he banged on the gates of mercy, meaning with his tfilos, and they were opened for him. So not only are there specific phrases in the Megillah that deal with prayer, Za'akasam, etc., etc., but also under the surface, there are references in the Megillah to prayer in the story. In fact, Mordechai's entire namesake is not just necessarily a namesake. It's a veiled reference to the powers that he worked with his tefillah. They enlightened the eyes of B'nai Yisrael. They caused Hashem to give an answer, a favorable answer. And they were the source, the force that opened up the gates of mercy. So we see from here that tefillah actually plays a very important role in the Purim story. And these are just some of the many references that our sages make to tefillah in the Megillah. And we see from here that prayer plays an integral role in the Purim story. Fine. Okay. That's just an introduction to tefillah in the Megillah, where it appears, where it doesn't appear, but really does appear, etc., etc. I want to move on now to something else. It's a beautiful Vart, beautiful Dvar Torah from the Chidushei Harim. Does the name sound familiar? Anybody ever hear of the Chidushei Harim? Know who that was? Chidushei Harim stands for Rabbi Yitzchak Meir. The Chidushei Harim is a book that Rabbi Yitzchak Meir of Gor, one of the Gerer Rebbe's, the Ger Chassidic Rebbeim, wrote a sefer called his Chidushim on Shas, which is now what people call him. They call him the Chidushei Harim, as we know that oftentimes when someone writes a sefer, they become known by the title of that sefer. It's a fascinating discussion for another time, why Jews do that. Jews are the only people who do that, who call authors after the names of their books. We say the Chafetz Chaim. His name was not Chafetz Chaim. What was his name? Anybody know? Kagan, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan. But his mother did not call him Chafetz Chaim. Chafetz Chaim, your soup is ready. No, that's what he named. He wrote a sefer called the Chafetz Chaim, and that's what people... So we have a tendency to name people after their books. That's an interesting phenomenon. It's a discussion for another time. Why exactly that happened? I have some thoughts about it. But in any case, the Chidushei Harim was subject to this phenomenon. But his name is Rabbi Yitzchak Meir, author of Gur. And he was a Hasidic Rebbe who lived mostly in the 1800s. He was born, I think, at the very end of the 18th century, in the year 1799. And he lived until 1866. And he suggests something fascinating and profound that I actually alluded to in the email that I sent out about our meeting today. But in order to understand it, we need to look at a Yerushalmi. Talmud Yerushalmi says something very interesting. Source number 4: Ein medaktikin b'mitzvas Purim ela kol mishu poshet es yado litol nos ninlo. That you do not check eligibility for the money given as Purim charity, but you actually give to everybody who extends their hands. In other words, the rest of the year, let's say someone comes to you for tzedakah, you have a right to look into the situation and verify that they're not just posing and they actually need that tzedakah money before you give it to them. You have the right to verify that they're actually going to use the money to support themselves and they're not just posing to get money when it's not actually necessary. In fact, I remember I was exercising in Manhattan, on the streets of Manhattan, and I used to run over the George Washington Bridge and back. And there are often people at the exit of the bridge when you're coming onto, I think, what's 178th Street in Manhattan. And there's a traffic light there, and there's a place to stand. And so people will stand there with signs asking for money. And I was running, so one of these people, this woman, comes over to me, and she says, "Do you have any money?" And I said, "The truth is, all I have right now is I'm running. I don't have anything on me." So I said, "Are you out here often?" So we started schmoozing a little bit. So I said, "How often are you out here?" She said, "Oh, this day." I'm like, "That's a lot of time." She says, "I know." I said, "Well, do you make a lot of money doing this?" And she said, "Well, it depends on the day, but right now I'm actually trying to raise enough money to go on a luxury vacation to St. John's." So I said to her, once she knew I wasn't giving her any money, she had no reason to lie. So I said, "Oh, so the money that you get when you're standing here asking for, you're going to use that to go to St. John's?" She said, "Yes." So, Okay. Look, the point is, unfortunately, not everybody means what they say they mean when they're going to, when they ask you for money. And during the rest of the year, you have the right and probably the prudence to look into such a matter. However, the Gemara tells us, Talmud Yerushalmi tells us that on Purim, that's not the case. On Purim, we do not inquire after the actual need to see if it's validated. We actually just give to whoever asks. And this is a halacha. This is not just an abstract Yerushalmi. The Shulchan Aruch paskins this way. In Shimon Tav Reish Tzadi Dalet, Siv Gimel, Ein Medaktikin B'maos Purim, Ela Kol Misha Poshet Yadu Litol Notnim Lo. That we do not exact regarding the monies of Purim, but we give anybody who extends their hand. They say, I need money, we give them. On Purim, we do not inquire after whether this is actually deserved or needed. Okay, does that make sense? And it leads us to, I think, a fascinating comment. The Chidushei HaRim writes something beautiful. This appears in the Chidushei HaRim al HaTorah, but as far as I know, this is not actually a sefer that he wrote. It's a collection of various things that he wrote in various places that someone then arranged afterwards according to the Parsha. So they took all of his comments and they said, oh, this works with Parsha Pikudei, this works with Parsha Svayikra, this is in the section on Purim. So it's not as if he wrote this in that format, but it comes from somewhere else in his writings. I just happened to copy it and paste the actual quote and source number 6 from his commentary on the Torah. And he asks a very interesting question. Someone pointed out at the beginning of this year that there is a mitzvah, according to many, to drink on Purim. Who's heard of this mitzvah? Mitzvah according to drink on Purim. And it's a very strange mitzvah because it's not clear why that should be the case. The Gemara says, "Chayav inish libusumi adlo yada ben araham and lebarach ben araham and lebarach Mordechai," and that's that. But why? Why are you supposed to get so drunk, according to some authorities? Why? So, over the years, many answers have been suggested to this question, but he presents a fascinating answer, and it actually has a lot to do with the role of tefillah on Purim. Writes the Chidushei HaRim the following. You have to get drunk on Purim. So there's a story. The story is told about the holy Baal Shem Tov. There was a certain righteous person who was so righteous that he merited to have all of his requests fulfilled. Whenever he davened for something, that was that. He got whatever he wanted. And this fellow was so powerful, and his tefillos were so successful, that he could even cause things which were decreed in heavens to be overturned, effectively uprooting the will of God. He had that much power with his tefillos. And he would cause good things to come down into the world that were not actually the will of God. And God would be forced, Hashem Yidbaruch Yikayim Osam, and God would have actually granted those decrees. Such was his power of tefilo. And so what happened? So Gazru Alav Mina Shemayim, so the heavens did something drastic. The heavens decreed upon him, that he would be a drunkard for the rest of his days. The idea here is that if the fellow is perennially drunk, he's not going to have the wherewithal to daven for anything. He's not going to have the cognitive lucidity necessary to make valiant requests. And he's going to, therefore, not be able to uproot the order of the world and cause all sorts of things to happen that are against the ratzon of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Okay, it's an interesting story. And so the Chidushei HaRim says maybe that's why we have an obligation to drink on Purim. V'zeh ma shegazru rabotenu zichronam livracha b'Purim. Ki halo ita b'Purim kol poshet yad notnin lo. We have a rule on Purim in the Talmud Yerushalmi that whenever someone asks for something, you have to give them. You do not get to be exacting about whether or not this is really deserved. You give them at face value. You give them. Okay. What?
Every day I'm just poor.
Purim. Just Purim. And he says, the same thing applies. That's just a veiled reference to tefillah. Therefore, on Purim, kol haposhit yad notnin lo is not just a rule that applies between a person asking for charity and another person. It applies between us and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. When we ask God for something on Purim, God is chayav to give it to us. Kol haposhit yad notnin lo. And therefore, he writes, because of the power that creates, in terms of our own ability to affect things with our tefillos, our sages obligated us to get drunk on Purim, so that we would not take our requests too far and abrogate the natural order of the world. Fascinating. Fascinating.
I'm really upset by this.
It's fascinating. We'll get there in 1 second, okay? I just want to finish explaining it. It's okay. You're allowed to be upset. You're allowed to be upset. The idea here, just to summarize, is that on Purim we have the power to affect marvelous things with our tefillos. And that power is beautiful, and it's also dangerous. It's also dangerous. It's dangerous because sometimes what we think is in our best interest is not actually in our best interest, for one. It's dangerous because sometimes God wants something to be a certain way, and we want it to be another way, and so we'll actually do things that controvert God's own desires for the way the world runs, which we believe are the best. And therefore, our sages created this obligation to drink on Purim to sort of handicap or curtail the efficacy of our own tefillos. Because when people are drunk, they're not as lucid and they're not able to focus as much on what they're doing and what they're saying. And therefore, there's an obligation to get drunk on Purim. I brought this in here not to talk about the obligation to get drunk on Purim, but about the efficacy of our tefillos on Purim. If you take the idea to its logical conclusion, the idea here is that the Chidushei Arim is saying that Kol HaPoshet Yad Notnin Lo is not just the principle between Adam and Chavera. It's also a principle between Adam and Makom. It's something that applies between humans and God, such that just as we are obligated to give someone who asks us for money on Purim, so too, without looking into it, so too does God answer our requests on Purim. Again, without looking into it. Normally, during the rest of the year, we make a request. God says, oh, you want something? All right, well, let's see. Let's see if you actually deserve it. Let's see if you actually need it. Let's see if you're worthy of it. Not on Purim. Not on Purim. So it turns out that intoxication is sort of a divine control mechanism to prevent us from taking things too far with our tefillos. Isn't that astonishing? It's astonishing, no?
Yeah.
It's a remarkable, remarkable comment. Annalise, not so thrilled. What are you thinking? Idea number one. Let's go on. The other idea that I wanted to discuss when it comes to Purim and the holiday of and prayer is best introduced by talking about a perek of Tehillim. Tehillim perek Chav Beis. Anybody know what this has to do with the Purim story? Our sages tell us that Tehillim perek Chav Beis was recited by Esther when she was in distress in Ahasuerus's palace. But the prayer starts Tehillim Perek Chav Beis Pasuk Aleph Lamnatzeach Al Ayelas Hashachar Mizmor the David, for the leader on the dawn of Psalm of David. What is Ayelat Hashachar? It's a strange word. Sometimes it means dawn. Ayelet or Ayala means like a female deer, can mean that in certain contexts. But the Midrash Tehillim, the Midrash, in source number 8, actually interprets this phrase, Ayalat HaShachar, Zo Esther, as a reference to Esther herself. In other words, Esther, the sages saw in the word Ayalat a reference to Esther. And the question is, how? What does one have to do with the other? What is the relationship between Ayelet HaShachar, which means a deer, or dawn, or daybreak? There are a number of possible meanings for that word, and Esther. And there are many answers given by the sages in the Gemara, in a number of different situations. One answer in the Gemara that has gotten a lot of press is that just as the Ayelet HaShachar comes right after the end of a night. It's the closing of the night and the beginning of the day. That's what daybreak is. So too, Esther was the end of a period of miracles for the Jews. Esther was sort of the miracle of Purim was sort of the last miracle that was done on the Jews' behalf. And the Gemara asks, but there are miracles that happened after Purim. Namely, what's the most famous one? Chanukah. So the Gemara asks that question. It's an interesting discussion. But essentially, that's one explanation for what this connection is between Ayelet HaShachar and Esther. However, the Midrash gives a different answer. It's fascinating. The Midrash says, Lama nimshla Esther kashachar. Our question, what is the analog here between Esther and Shachar and daybreak? Ma HaShachar olev al-kav chavim shokim. Just as when the dawn emerges, all of the stars descend, meaning the light is what makes the stars disappear. So too, Af Esther beveis Achashverosh Haisa Ola v'Haman uvanav shokim, that the sun would rise and the stars would start to descend. They would start to disappear. In other words, Esther is like the light of day, and Haman is represented by the darkness of night. And just as the sun, when the sun ascends, the darkness descends, so too, as Esther ascended in stature in Ahasuerus's palace, so too Haman descended. And you can see that as throughout the Purim story, that the more powerful and important Esther is, the less powerful and important Haman gets. And so Esther, therefore, plays sort of the same role as a rising sun or as daybreak in the Purim story. Fine. Now, the Maharal, in his Sefer Or Chadash, has anybody ever heard of the Sefer Or Chadash? Or Chadash is the Maharal's commentary on Megillas Esther. It's a beautiful commentary, and it has a very beautiful introduction that we're about to read part of right now. And so he notes this. He says that Esther story is called, and he elaborates on this idea. Look in source number 9. I'm going to read it in English just for the sake of brevity. He says the redemption affected by Esther is called daybreak. L'chach nichra geulas Esther shachar. Why? Ki halaylu hu choshech v'kodem alos hashachar hu choshech nosaf al choshech. The redemption affected by, the sages refer to this whole Esther story, the redemption that she wrought, as an ayalas hashachar, as a daybreak, or as a coming dawn, because nighttime is dark. And what's the darkest part of night? The end. It's always, the saying goes, it's always darkest just before the dawn. That's true. It's not the darkest at 8 p.m. It's darker the later into the night you get. And he says the same thing. So the Maharal says that at nighttime, it gets dark. But by the time it's really late at night, meaning right before it's about to be morning again, it's the darkest. It's sort of doubly dark. And he said that is the same state that characterized the Jews during the Purim story. Look at what he says. Because the Jews were already in exile under the rule of Achashverosh. That's already a darkness. We were in exile. Even if nothing bad is happening, that fact alone is enough to be considered a darkness. And now an additional darkness arose, namely the problems with Haman. So there was the baseline darkness of the Jewish experience of exile. On top of that, there's now this very immediate threat of Haman and the destruction of the Jewish people. So things are extra dark right now, just as they are right before daybreak. This is analogous to the last part of the nighttime, where things are exceptionally dark. Does this make sense so far? Okay, great. And the redemption of Esther, which came about because of prayer, because at that time they sat in darkness, and it was like a horizon that is completely dark without light. But their prayers went out like a ray of light that shines forth and refracts, and the horizon itself splits. In other words, the prayers of the Jewish people were the thing that caused some of the darkness to dissipate. As it is written in the Talmud Yerushalmi, that the light of daybreak is what shatters the darkness, growing continually larger. And he says, and there was no redemption that was brought about through prayer like this one. As it is written in Esther, we just read this, that their za'akot, they're crying out. Therefore, our redemption is named after prayer and is called Ayelas HaShachar, because they strengthened themselves in prayer and their prayer went out to work, effectively dissipating the darkness. In other words, the Purim miracle, the miracle that Esther brought about, is called Ayelas HaShachar. Esther herself is called Ayelas HaShachar, because the Jewish people were in a very dark period, akin to the very end of the night. There was the general threat of exile, the reality of exile, and then there was the additional threat of Haman. And Esther, and really also the tefillos of the Jewish people, were a light that caused the darkness to dissipate, very much like the sun causes the darkness of nighttime to dissipate. And so therefore, our sages called the Purim redemption the redemption of Ayelas HaShachar, because it is analogous to the story of events of night ending and daybreak actually starting to, and daybreak starting to fall. In other words, we see from here a few things. Number one, that the redemption came about through tefillah. The Maharal writes beautifully that it's the tefillos that shined forth from people's mouths that then went and caused the darkness to dissipate. They shattered the darkness. It was the tefillot that started to bring some light into the world after Haman had tried to go about committing his evil decrees. Because a world without prayer is like a sky without light. It's dark. And therefore our story is called the story of the dawn, because the prayer acted for them like a dawn, which displaced the darkness. Does that make sense? And prayer, we can see now, plays a beautiful story, a beautiful role in this story, and really in life. Prayer is a ray of light that can displace darkness. Prayer is the ray of light that did displace the darkness in the Purim story. And I think that is something that we can all remember. And I think the takeaway here, and with this we'll conclude, that what do we see from all this? What do we see? Well, we learned some interesting halachos of Purim about giving tzedakah and things like that. Fine. But I think we live in an exceedingly dark time. Since October 7th, things have been dark. The world is an increasingly inhospitable place. And the messages of Purim and prayer are becoming more and more important. First of all, number one, the notion that on Purim everybody's tefillos have special power. That kol haposhei diyar notzim lo applies not just to tzedakah, but also to tefillah, I think should inspire us to take to the shuls on Purim with increased vigor and confidence and hope. That's number one. We can use the day of Purim not just to rejoice, but and enjoy a suuda with friends, even though those are all important, but also to pray, but also to daven. Because on Purim there is profound potential for our prayers to work, even in ways that are not possible during the rest of the year. And number two, the Maharal. Number two, when times are dark, and again, certainly they are dark right now, we need to remember that prayer can be for us a ray of light, literally the thing that shatters the darkness. Tefillah is something that can inspire within us hope. We've spoken in past sessions about how the word tefillah actually comes from the word to hope. And tefillah is something that can give us the potential for a brighter day, for a brighter future, when we're so stuck in the current, in our own darkness, in our own pain and suffering. That we should remember that when life is dark, and even when it's doubly dark, even when there is not just the threat of exile, but the threat of annihilation, but the threat of extermination, but the threat of death, quite frankly, of suffering, that tefillah can shed light, even in those moments. That tefillah can be the thing that brings us me'afela li'ora, mishibu to the ge'ula, but only if we use it. Only if we use it. Not if we despair. It's because the Jews did not despair during the Purim story, but took to their own tefillos, that tefillos actually were able to break up the darkness. And it is through our own tefillos in the current era that hopefully we will merit this destruction and this infighting and this outfighting, all of it to end. May this Purim bring about the answer to our prayers. May it bring about the end of our exile. And may it bring us the peace and security that we so desperately need. Okay. If you want to hold on to your source sheets, you can. Otherwise, you can put them up front. I'm happy to stick around for any questions. And we'll meet in 2 weeks from today, 2 p.m. Have a Freilichin Purim.